My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. So glad to be with you once again. This week on the show, I am joined by singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Elizabeth Nelson of the DC band The Paranoid Style. Their new album is called The Interrogator, and it taps into classic pub rock, punk, roots rock energy. It's a lot of fun, and on top of all that, Elizabeth is one of my favorite rock writers. I'm using that term, rock writer, because it sort of specifies the kind of critic that I'm talking about when I think about Elizabeth's work. I think of her as somebody in the sort of Lester Bang school, but totally with her own viewpoint and totally with her own flair. She just really, really gets it. And it was so much fun to have her on to talk about, you know, favorite shared records. We talk about the Mekons a bunch and ZZ Top. We talk a lot about the weird way that the internet age sort of has everybody wanting to pretend to just be a brand and what it means to push back against that. We talk about X. We talk about, you know, Joe Eli. We talk about how synth pop informs the roots sound of the late 80s. Anyway, it was just a great chat, really loose and all over the place, and I had a lot of fun with it, and so that's what you're about to hear. Before we settle in, of course, want to let you know that if you want to support us at Aquarium Drunkard, head over to the Patreon and pledge your support. We're an independent outfit, but that's the best way that you can help us keep doing what we are doing. Okay, here it is, my conversation with Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style. Thanks so much for hanging out with us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I will speak with you a little more on the other side.
Ugly words are exchanged at a charity event. You don't even have a tenth of your rent. People are run over by ambulances. You attack those with the lowest of defenses. Your pulse is slow, your self-esteem is wavering. Everything that's low is everything that you've been savoring. Then you look in the mirror, and do you change your mind? Does the fear breed fear? Are you loathsome tonight? Are you loathsome tonight? Are you loathsome tonight? Are you loathsome tonight?
Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time to join us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. Really looking forward to getting to talk to you about The Interrogator.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to do this, and I am looking forward to talking to you about The Interrogator as well.
Yeah, you're one of those people who I feel there aren't many. Well, I guess there are plenty, but you use the platform formerly known as Twitter or X now. You use it very well, and you have a very unique style on there, and I've always loved, you've been a great follow, of course. Not that that is the only place that people can access your writing, but I just wanted to start off by saying that, you know, we so often complain about the quality or lack thereof of these social media platforms. I think that your X presence sort of speaks to the truth that there are a lot of different ways you can do it, and that it can be cool and fun, you know?
I appreciate that very much. And I know that we are in a current time culturally. I don't know that we've ever not been in a current time culturally where Twitter or X is really not that popular and not everyone's favorite social media platform. I have stuck with it. And I know that that might also be an unpopular decision. But I signed up for it basically as a professional obligation, as a journalist. And I'm sure you know this, having this sense of like, you have to have a Twitter account, you have to have a social media presence of some kind. So I just signed up for it because I felt like I had to. And then I made the decision to kind of make it good rather than just using it as a place to share sundry random musings that nobody cares about or whatever. And I enjoyed the challenge of the, I believe it was 140 originally, now it's 280 characters. Like, as a writer, that's sort of an intoxicating idea to try and be efficient. So, yeah. I took it perhaps as, a project that maybe I took a little too seriously, given that I'm not getting paid for it. But I've enjoyed it, and I've actually enjoyed the community that has grown out of my Twitter following, if I can say that. I mean, there's a bunch of, really, really wonderful people who I've met and have got to talk to about music, and that's been super fun. And so, like, I'm not, I do not have any ownership stake in X, so I am not their spokesperson, right. But I do think that I'm still trying to make it like a nice place to just talk about music. And yeah, we'll get an occasional reply guy in the conversation who kind of sucks or whatever, but it's actually a very, very civil discourse. And so I appreciate you saying that and bringing it up, because I've definitely like met really, really nice people, and obviously, have connected with other writers and other music fans, and that's been awesome. And people have found the band through that and found my writing as well. So it's been good for me. And really, that's what it's all about, right, Jason?
Well, and it's all about what works for each one of us on an individual level. No, of course. Yeah, no, the complications you bring up are obvious for sure, especially now. It is weirder. I will say, I don't intend for us to spend a lot of our time talking about Twitter or X, but the reason I was, previously verified, right, in the previous world, the previous version, and I've been so resistant to pay for that, verification. It's not like I don't want some of those tools. I guess the fact that you can edit, that's nice, because sure. I've definitely wanted to delete tweets or fix them or whatever. But I won't pay to do this because I'm already providing the content. You know what I mean? Like, right. We are working. A few years back, I interviewed the songwriter Liam Hayes, and he said something along the lines of, you're making this great content for somebody else, yeah. But that said, in the old days, it definitely felt like a way to create some awareness of your work, and like you said, the communities that have grown up from it. I don't relish the idea of like abandoning that community, even if I'm getting served the most bizarre and heinous ads that I've ever seen. You know what
sure.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe this is something that I'm perhaps using Twitter incorrectly, in that I don't tend to like do a lot of scrolling through the feed. So no, I
think
tend
you're doing
to
it
see.
Very correctly.
I mean, your definition of correct, it depends on what that is, I guess. But I try not to like, engage too much with all of like the weird and terrible things that might come through on the feed unsolicited. But I totally agree with you. I wouldn't pay to have a verification. I mean, I think that's just terrible. And I mean, I agree with you. I feel like I can't remember if it was Mark Maron or Tom Sharpling, but they were talking to each other on one of their, Maron and Sharpling podcasts.
The Mark and Tom show. Yeah.
The Mark and Tom show. Thank you so much. And I love those episodes, but they were talking about Twitter and it was still Twitter back then. I think it was Mark that said, yeah, I don't feel like working for them for free anymore, so I'm not going to do that. Maybe it was Tom, but they, you know, they're kind of interchangeable in some ways in that regard. And I was just like, yeah, man, you know, like we do work for free for Twitter. And I don't want to spend too much time on Twitter either, but I had received an email once from somebody who follows me because I will sometimes, replay the hits and bring back an old tweet and
sure.
I'll modify it a little bit. And again, as a writing exercise, that's really fun. But he was calling me out on bringing back an old tweet. And I had to say to him, this isn't my job. And you're not guaranteed original content from me every day. Like, I'm sorry if that was the delusion that you're laboring under.
Yeah.
But this is just like sort of a fun thing. And if I feel like bringing back that Zevon tweet, you're just going to have to live with it. And if you don't like it, like there's a ton of other stuff. I mean, as I understand it, there's like free pornography everywhere. So yeah. You could like get into that if you don't like that tweet for the day. It's a little bit of a confounding space to exist in because there's this compulsion to provide this original content. And
absolutely.
Obviously it's always fun to get new followers or to, you know, see where it gets weirdly viral. But also I've got a day job, I've got a band, I've got a ton of other things going on where it's like, well, you know what, today we're just going to bring back that old tweet and see how it does. And so anyway, it's a weird place to bring one's content. And again, If I ever found out that somebody else was capitalizing on it, and they probably are, but in some way that was really egregious to me, I'd probably stop. But I haven't had that impulse yet.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, though, because when we talk about Twitter, I mean, I guess to some degree, it's like the apocalypse is in the air right now, you know?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I feel like people feel like an apocalyptic sense about that platform, but I don't think that it's actually about just that platform.
Right.
I think it's like, obviously this web, you know, this version of the internet that we understand is in the midst of kind of going away. And
mm-hmm.
obviously people are so inherently wired to assume that when it goes away, something, you know, worse will replace it. But,
right.
you know, I don't know, maybe that's not the case, right? Like maybe it going away would one be fine and
mm-hmm.
two, maybe we would figure out better ways to do stuff. But that apocalyptic tone and the character of, I guess really it feels like these last couple of years because they mm-hmm. have been absolutely apocalyptic in terms of the real, you know, root word there, you know, apocalypse meaning like some sort of revealing. It feels like a lot of the old narratives just don't hold anymore. And I feel like mm-hmm. with the new record, you're able to talk about that in a really fun way and a really kind of like sneaky and subversive mm-hmm. way to talk about that apocalyptic thing. You know, it really does feel like everybody's convinced that it's all going down, I think, as you say, you know, in one of the songs, and it is, but what that means, you know, it's hard to fault people for feeling cynical or nihilistic, mm-hmm. but at the mm-hmm. same time, I don't know, you know, what are the positive sides of the apocalypse? You know, that's what I'm curious about.
Well, I mean, for sure it's, you know, great grist for the songwriting mill.
Sure is.
But I'm inclined to agree with you. And I definitely appreciate that you have kind of picked up on this like thematic thread of the new record. Because, you know, and I mean, you know, you sort of brought this up in your comments. Like I definitely think that We are living in this time of limitless distortions and corruptions. And I think it is something that, you know, we're all kind of feeling in our bones. And so, you know, as a person who comes from like a union background and, you know, with a working class sentiment, you know, the major themes of the paranoid style have always been like the social engineering of class and consensus. And I can understand why, you know, we're so popular, because God knows this is what people want in their rock songs.
Yeah.
But even by the accustomed standards, we sense that things are worsening and hardening, and the margins are smaller for operating.
Yeah.
Outside of the circumscribed systems of capitalism and the corporate tech duopoly. And economic mobility is harder generation by generation. And I think like we're all feeling that. And even access to art that isn't, you know, God bless her, and I'm very sorry to say this, but like is not Taylor Swift, feels increasingly impermissible. And so I kind of feel like the door has closed behind us and everyone pretty much has to use technology to exist. So we're implicated, and God knows I am, but that was a big theme of the record. And that sense of, I mean, apocalypse, you know, for sure. I mean, maybe that's putting too fine a point on it, but I definitely feel like it's pretty bleak, and it has felt that way for a while.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, part of what I think part of the reason why I'm so drawn to the term apocalypse to describe what, let's say, and it's kind of weird, right? Because it's not, I think we tend to think of apocalypses as instantaneous and all taking hold at once or whatever, but that's not really the way it's worked. If you look at it, it's been sort of a slow motion roll out of all of this insanity, and it's all been in our midst for a lot longer than we're even willing to imagine sometimes, right? And so I think that the reason why I like apocalypse as an idea is because, you know, an apocalypse means that a certain way, like the veil has been lifted. Now, what's upsetting about that, of course, is that with it go all of those illusions that maybe were a lot easier to cling to even a little while ago. But there's also a kind of wild sense of freedom that comes with it. And I feel like that's something that I pick up on in the record as well. You know, I think there's a lyric in a couple of lyrics about rock and roll in the song That Drop Is Steep, which is great. My favorite of them was something about rock and roll makes me feel defensive. And, you know, in a certain way, I've been thinking about like what rock and roll even symbolizes in 2024. You know, what does rock and roll mean? And I found myself thinking a lot. You're somebody who's written very eloquently, probably my favorite thing that I've read from you is your piece about the Mekons from a few years back. And I always think about, you know, their song Rock and Roll.
Yes.
and that line, destroy your safe and happy home before it is too late. That's such a bleak sounding line, but I think that's that wild careening freedom that I'm talking about. Like, I think we have to sort of embrace that right now. We have to like tap into that, because it's going to fall apart one way or the other. And if we lose, I don't know. I don't want to get on a high horse, but you don't, do you know what, are you picking up on sort of that, what I'm talking about there?
I definitely do. And I think like as an opening gambit for a song, you can't do much better than that. And the way that it gets delivered is with such joy.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's threatening to say destroy your safe and happy lives before it's too late, but it's also like, you know, this is what we're doing now, and we're really happy about it. I mean, like I find, you know, the Mekons to be incredibly inspiring, and obviously, you know, one of the bands that I look to as beacons. And so, yes, I can completely see you. And I mean, yeah. And they named their record Rock and Roll. If that influence is existing on the interrogator, I would 100% own that.
Yeah, you know, they're one of those bands, the Mekons, where I liked the Mekons and I like stuff from them, but there's a lot, and it's a little bit of a, I think if you're wired a certain way, and maybe this is the way I am wired, you know, towards like a certain kind of completism or whatever, sometimes those bands with massive discographies just, you end up putting off engagement with them for whatever reason, you know, maybe sort of a subconscious or an unconscious defense, who knows. But but I, a couple years back when that Adam Curtis documentary came out, the Can't Get You Out of My Head, there's some Mekons on the soundtrack, and I just went very hard into the discography and found so much to like delve into. In some ways, I think maybe we save those bands for when we need them, even in the backs of our, I know someday, like I'm gonna actually figure out whether or not I hate Frank Zappa. You know what I mean? Like I still haven't figured out whether or not I actually have an opinion. I've got that Reuben and the Jets record. That's pretty good, but that's like all I've got, you know, and maybe some others, but I know someday I'm gonna wander down that rabbit hole. I don't know. Are you obsessive about discographies like that too?
I for sure. In as much as I'm obsessive about anything, I totally get what you mean. Like it took me a really, really long time to dive into Steely Dan. And
a band that nobody on the internet talks about. You don't hear anything about Steely Dan on the internet.
and I was invited to talk to Joan LeMay and Alex Papademos about their amazing.
It's great.
What is that called? God, my mind is not good with titles today.
It was their Quantum Criminals. Their great book. We had them on the pod. Yeah.
So great. And they, Alex wrote to me very kindly and said, you know, you seem like the kind of person who would like Steely Dan, you know, you like rock and roll and you like golf and you just, you know, and you're an East Coast person. And, you know, he's like, so do you want to talk to Joan and me? And I was like, well, you know, I'm the furthest thing from a Danimal, but, you know, this seems like the right time. And honestly, that was the right book too. I mean, between Joan's drawings, our paintings and Alex's prose, which is frustratingly good, just so good. It really helped provide the kind of guide that I needed to delve into such a dense discography and, you know, such really funny but dark lyrics. And it's all glossed over with their just totally fastidious production and playing. And so, and I would scarcely say that I have delved into it. Zap is another one that seems impenetrable to me. My explorations of Lil George's career make it seem like he's not any fun at all. So I've been less likely to dive into that because it, you know, he just seems like he's just not a good hang. But I know what you mean about being obsessive and then, yeah, like finding that band that's going to be the thing that you become like deeply involved in. And it's always really fun when you find that thread that you can kind of start pulling on and uncovering all of these great songs. And, you know, Mekons are fun too, because like, they're all in like a billion different bands, or at least Langford has like six different side projects, a bunch of different records. You know, are they all as strong as you know, our favorites? I'm not really in a position to say that, but no, I mean, you know, some are better than others, but they're all at least interesting.
Yeah, no, very, very much so. And yeah, I mean, yeah, that it's funny because I think you bringing up the Quantum Criminals is really fascinating because it was such a good music book. And I feel like the best criticism, and this is stuff that's very rare now, and it's, you know, the best music writing is when it feels like the writer is like adding, like, I feel like in a funny way, Papademos with that book and with that prose, you know, he's drawing from the source material 100%. And he's like, he's like identifying things in the source material that get glossed over or that people don't pick up on, you know? But he's also doing so in this way where it's like he's adding his own humor and taste and personality into it. And I feel like, you know, as somebody who writes about music as well as somebody who plays it, you know, we know that like the best records are when somebody's personality cracks through and shades the music in a way that only that person could. Mm-hmm. I'm very frustrated that so much music writing professionally tends to beat the personality out of any given author. Does that, you know, sort of resonate with you?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And I completely agree with you. And I think that was one of the great strengths of Quantum Criminals is that there is so much of Alex's voice in there. Yeah. And it's just so natural and so funny. And his observations are often, at least to me, not a huge Steely Dan fan, like pretty unique. And so it's very cool. And obviously, when you're writing a book, I guess you get the luxury of not having to conform to editorial standards. And I guess, you know, I'm sure that lots of people have worked with editors who are just groovy and, you know, will let you get away with a lot of stuff. And then there are other people who have very, very strong ideas about what the, you know, brand voice is or what right. the publication's brand voice is, and having to kind of adhere to that. And it just bleeds the music out of it. I hate that kind of writing. And I won't mention any publications or any editors by name, but you can always tell. And I totally agree with you. And so it's always nice when you get to enjoy somebody's writerly voice in long form, like in a book or whatever. So yeah, I felt like that was a true gift.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. As somebody who has, like I said, somebody who writes about music and plays it, mm-hmm. Has that always been the case? Did the music come first and the writing later, or was it the other way around? How did the sequence of events play out for you?
I started playing music pretty early on, like when I was a kid. So I've always written songs, and then the writing piece of it came later. I mean, the two of them are handmaidens, I think, you know, and, you know, you're a musician and a writer. So, having one skill, I think, actually bolsters the other really nicely, like being able to write about an album while trying to create an album, I think lends itself really well. So I'd be interested to hear your experience in dealing with this, like when you put out a record and you're doing press for it, because over the course of my illustrious career, like I think that it's been difficult for some folks to figure out like what exactly it is that I do. And it's almost counterintuitive that like I could be both a writer and a songwriter, which is like kind of annoying, because it seems like for whatever reason, this has been a psychological hurdle for certain people. And I mean, it makes it difficult for people to want to review my records, because they're like, but you know, like you're Twitter, right? Like that's what you do. And you write about the music. And I mean, maybe it's just my experience and maybe I'm just super sensitive about it, but you know, lots of great songwriters, whether it's Lenny Kaye or Patti Smith or Ira Kaplan, all started out, you know, as writers. But you know, I think always were writing songs as well and had that career. I mean, Thurston Moore was also,
the
person who started writing record reviews. And so, I don't think anybody like blanches at the idea that Jeff Tweedy writes books. It's always interesting. So what has your experience been like? Do people like think of you as being one thing in particular, or are they able to handle a hyphenate?
Well, I mean, I didn't have to do all that much press or didn't get to do all that much press, whichever way you want to phrase that. it was fine. I really enjoyed talking with the folks I talked to about my music, it's really been like an incredible thing to share music with people that I've created after a long time of, you know, commenting on others. That was a huge thing for me. Mm-hmm. When people did talk to me about the record, there were a lot of questions that focused very much on the sort of dual, that notion of duality or an either or,
right.
You know, and people were really interested in what, you know, how I, you know, sort of viewed it. And I mean, for me, I know exactly what you're saying. Like, they are tied together in so many ways, and they do feed into each other. For me, you know, the themes often that I'm talking about or exploring on this podcast, you know, are themes that are resonant to me, and they make their way into the art and all that stuff. But regardless, people did tend to say, you know, like, you're somebody who's written about music. What does it feel like to put music out into the world?
Right.
And the kind of like boring thing for me was that it felt pretty natural once I stopped like thinking about it. Because when I was thinking about it, it did seem semi-problematic. You know what I mean? Because it's like, I have never been somebody who's written like really damning reviews or been like a real snark machine.
Right.
But there are examples of that in my, you know, early days for sure. And
of course.
And I have said that I don't like things before, and I have, you know, weighed in. I think the main thing for me was that, like, it always seemed, I found a sort of footing in that old idea of like, yeah, who cares though? I'm allowed to say I don't like something. It doesn't actually mean that it isn't for anybody, you know?
Right.
And so I guess that's the thing, is that people do tend towards a sort of totalizing like viewpoint. And I do think that I had people who, I know that there are people who are like, you know, well, who's he think he is, like putting a record out or whatever, you know? And it's like, I don't think I'm anybody, you know, but nonetheless, like when you think about music the way that you have, you know, it's, and I mean, like so many of my favorite songwriters, right? People like John Darnielle writes songs about musicians that are, you know, that put the best rock writing to shame, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, and that's the same. You ever read Lou Reed talking about doo-wop, you know? It's just like, it's like, yeah, these are not contradictory things.
Yes.
But I do find what you're saying really, really bums me out on one hand, because I know what you're talking about when people want to say like, your Twitter, you're this, you're that, like anything out of the established brand as somebody perceives you seems to cause confusion or duress to folks. And it's kind of a bummer, because it feels like, you know, that sort of reducing people down to brands is kind of a drag.
Yeah, totally. And it's a weird one to have to kind of, you know, deal with like in real time, especially because, like, I mean, it's, you know, while some people may have, you know, heard my name because of something that I wrote, because it was published in a, you know, major publication that goes out to, you know, thousands, if not more, you know, viewers or readers or whatever. And like, you know, obviously playing in a, you know, political garage rock band on, you know, a really great independent label, but an independent label nevertheless, when we're in this era of, you know, massive influx of distraction and, you know, tons of bands, tons of new music, but also this completely consensus driven machine where we really can't escape, you know, the top five big names in pop or rock or whatever. You know, so it's like, I can't say I'm surprised that it's not like, hey, you know, like, you're, you know, the lead singer songwriter of the Paranoid Style. Like, I don't expect people to just know that, because, like, you, like you, I'm not anybody. But it is frustrating, like, to, for example, I will share an anecdote from my life. I played on a not insubstantial bill for a popular radio program, and there was another act on the bill who was somebody that I was nominally aware of, and I got introduced to this person, and he said, "Oh, I just thought you were on Twitter. I didn't, you know, realize that, you know, you were, you know," like, I had to put it together, and I'm like, "Yeah, okay." I mean, you know, it's just, like, so deflating, because you're trying to be, like, polite and you know, like, say, you know, like, "Oh yeah, I, you know, like, I'm friends with this person that you know, and, like, they say great things about you, and I'm really excited to hear you play." And it's just like, "Oh, you know, like, I follow your Twitter, and I didn't realize that you had this band," and it's totally okay, but it's always just like, it's a little just like, it just puts, like, a slight chill in my spine sometimes to have to just walk away from a conversation like that before performing.
Yeah, no, well, no kidding. Before you're getting ready to do your thing, that's especially annoying. But, you know, it's kind of like, it's kind of like when you interview or talk with, like, an actor who is now playing music, right?
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
There's this, like, it's frustrating the way societally we end up putting these sort of frames around a person and defining them by something that they, like, one thing that they do. And of course we know that's, like, that's not good. And we, of course, we know that that's, like, reductive and bad.
Right.
And yet we're online, and our brains are trying to make sense of so many people in the universe existing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So for somebody to do something that registers with you, even, you know, it's like that ends up creating this sort of imprint, and then that's, like, hard to get around. But also, when you're hanging out with somebody backstage, it's not that hard to get around, because you're not on Twitter, you're in real life now.
I know.
And you have to remember that, like, people go to eat, you know, at restaurants and hang out with their families and have complicated feelings about Star Trek Enterprise. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like what somebody posts about online is not the summation of their life. But in a weird way, we've culturally deluded ourselves into sort of imagining that it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
We call people NPCs, right? I don't call people NPCs, but people get referred to as non-playable characters or whatever, you know? It's like everybody's in a movie in their head or whatever, and they're the only character that's real.
Exactly. Which is, I mean, it starts to, you know, really, really head down the road of a kind of madness. If you start to think too deeply on it.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. Something I wanted to mention to you, though, was I love the ZZ Top nods on the record. And I think that ZZ Top are, while majorly famous, like famous in the real way of being famous, like where a lot of people know who they are. I still think they're way weirder, weirder than they get credit for. They're way more out there. They're way deeper layered. They are like, they are in the weirdest way, I'm going to say it, they are Lynchian, like a Lynchian construction of like so many layers of things. I'm curious to hear your reflections on ZZ Top and how, I mean, have you always dug ZZ Top?
I don't know that anybody who doesn't dig ZZ Top. You'd have to be some kind of monster to not enjoy the pleasures that those records offer us. So I've always, of course, been a huge fan. They're incredible, and obviously their video aesthetic is aspirational. I like the consistency. I feel like it's something that I can rely on. And I mean, you know, they're monster players and they seem like cool guys. But I am with you 100%. At a minimum, Billy Gibbons is weird.
Yeah.
And I say that as an honorific. I think he's got an enormous intellectual curiosity that goes well beyond what we would normally associate with like Texas Boogie and, you know, Legs, which, by the way, is Legs is an incredible song. But it's so, I mean, there's so many things happening. And I mean, this is like the most damning thing that I'm going to do in the interview, but there was a point in time where I tweeted about ZZ Top's Eliminator, which is a record that I love, and it was one of the major touchstones for The Interrogator. And I had learned, I think through my friend Wikipedia, that Gibbons had been getting very deeply into like 80s electronic music, like Depeche Mode. And he was so intrigued by the use of synths and, you know, like Lynn drums and all of, you know, these electronic touches that for this band that seems to be, you know, like as one with the earth in terms of how organic their sound could be, you know, playing, you know, mostly electric guitars and drums, like that he would have this interest in this totally different style of music and wanting to apply it to his brand of, you know, something that was, you know, really quite popular at the time. And then, you know, like, you know, I don't think it was a cynical flex where he was like, well, we've got to, you know, sound like this Depeche Mode band, so, you know, let's get some synths in here and really, you know, trick out the drums. I mean, like, I think he legitimately was like, this is incredibly exciting music and I want to make something that sounds like this, because obviously there's more to this world than, you know, just playing guitar like a beast. And like, I think that's so cool, but I think it suggests a person who is thinking about a lot of things all of the time. And I would love to get inside his brain and understand what's going on, because I think there's a lot of really awesome things happening. And he just seems like the coolest person and just so inspiring. Is that kind of your impression too of his general weirdness, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. But I think for me, I mean, what you're saying is accurate. Like, I don't think it was a cynical move towards more commercial sounds. I think they took to the MTV age because they were always showmen. There was always a performative, outsized kind of side to their presentation. And so I feel like MTV, you know, they made sense for MTV in the weirdest way. I also love that all the original MTV bands were just bands that had been around long enough to be able to make something like a music video, right? Like, the MTV didn't have, you know, its cultural cachet came as it grew, and then you could respond to it. But in the beginning, you know, I think ZZ Top they were able to visualize their music in a way that was really important, you know, but that had always been a part of what they were doing. Yeah. When you add the synth element to it, that's when it gets so fascinating. And when I was kind of younger, I think I pinned more importance on these ideas of authenticity or something. So I liked the earlier records, you know, I didn't like Eliminator so much. I like Tres Hombres. But, you know, and I mean, you can like both and should.
Sure.
Because what happened was once I actually started to realize what Eliminator was, that's when it became, you know, you used the term in the notes with the record. You said that to you, that sounds like heaven, you know, the sort of like pairing of these boogie guitars beautifully distorted with these synths and these insane drums. And to me, I completely agree. One, it reminds me specifically of driving around with my grandparents in the Southwest on summer vacations, where they would drive us in their camper van and trailer to like various national mm-hmm. parks and stuff. And my grandpa, for whatever reason, not a synth. Let's just put it this way: my grandpa would not have had an OMD CD in the, or you know, tape in the van. He wouldn't have had a Depeche Mode record, but he had Eliminator, and it. I mean, it literally sounds simultaneously like the future and the past, and that yeah. is the greatest thing that music can do. And bizarrely, or at least to me, at least, it sounds much less dated production-wise than some of its contemporaries. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I think I do. Yeah. And what a wonderful memory of driving around with your grandfather.
Oh, my God. Like, yeah, just these playing. these huge, like, you know, Utah sound, like, you know, landscapes sprawling out in all ways. And I was probably like just kind of like coming into awareness, you know,
yeah.
of like yeah. what being was. It was great. Yeah. ZZ Top is such a, and the way you employ their, you know, some of their moves is really, it's really cool. And I think it's really, I think that they warrant more credit for the kind of unique synthesis they did. A couple of years back, you also covered the Roseanne Cash song, 7 Year Ache. And to yeah. me, I mean, they don't sound the same. ZZ Top doesn't sound the exact same as Roseanne Cash, but there's a similar spiritual open-heartedness in the way that these quote-unquote roots players and, yeah. and you know, and people were embracing textures and synthetic textures and art pop, you know, and the future and all of that stuff. So to me, it's like that's a classic example of a song that it's just like it sounds of its time, but also it does yeah. sound unmoored from it in some really cool way to me.
I totally agree with you, and that's such a good example. That particular Roseanne Cash recording is so much of its time, but that song is so bulletproof. It's yeah. so perfect. And I mean, yes, it definitely has the patina of like, this is definitely an 80s production. The video especially will, you know, verify that. But, you know, that's one of those songs that you hear and you're like, so who wrote this back, you know, 500 years ago? Because yeah. it's one that we've always known. I mean, you know, it's always shocking to me when somebody comes out of the gate with a song that's just so perfect like that. And it's, there's nothing wrong. You can arrange that song as many different ways as you want, and it's always going to sound great.
Yeah.
I maintain that. That's the challenge to all the listeners of this podcast. Send us your arrangements of Roseanne Cash's 7 Year Ache and try to make it bad, because you can't. It's just a perfect song.
Yeah.
And I love that recording too. And I love the fact that, you know, she comes from this grand country tradition and, you know, didn't lean into that and instead, you know, made this thing that sounds like, you know, it's just it, like, I mean, everything is pretty much synthesized on it as far as I can tell. And it sounds beautiful. It's yeah. just a beautiful record.
Yeah. It's funny. Sometimes when I quite like the War on Drugs, And I also, this is complete kind of, well, it's not a complete aside because they've worked together recently, but I found myself strangely interested in The Killers' more recent records as well, in that they're employing some of that late 80s synth grandeur. And I think it ends up sort of conjuring up some imagined, idealized past, you know? And it's funny now because the synths that were so of their time and felt so could be read as like dated, those are now the sounds of 30, 40 years ago, you know? And so it's like those pick up this imaginal nostalgic patina as well, so that now if you sound like a song from 1989, in 2012 that would have been annoying, and in 2024 it's like it somehow is perfect. Do you know what I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think I do know what you mean, and I lament to say that I don't know that much about the War on Drugs or The Killers, but the fact that they might be employing those kinds of touches doesn't surprise me, because I do feel like it's certainly a trend. And that's dismissive.
Tunnel of Love core. Let's call it that. You know,
I love that.
And to me, that's also, there was a point where I couldn't touch Tunnel of Love with a 10-foot pole as the kind of rock fan that I was. Uh-huh. Now, it's like maybe second only to, I mean, I don't know. It's maybe better than Nebraska even. I don't know. You know, Tunnel of Love is such an incredible record. But it took me a while. It took me a while for those sounds to register. I guess that's what I'm sort of alluding to there.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very accurate. And I do love the idea of Tunnel of Love core. is that actually a term that is in the, you know, the common parlance?
I think we might have just made it up. I'm sure Stephen Hayden has already said it at some point.
Yeah,
I don't have any proof, but I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. But who knows? It's funny though, because we brought up, I mean, thinking about Roseanne Cash, I'm curious. Do you dig the first couple Carlene Carter records a lot as well?
I definitely. Which records are we talking about exactly?
I'm thinking of the one that has basically Rock Pile backing her up.
Yeah.
And I think it's self-titled.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the one that she did with Rock Pile is great. I've got Ceci Baum, which I like quite a bit too.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if Rock Pile is backing her on that or not. I know Barney Bubbles did the artwork, so I assume Rock Pile, but that could just be the conflation. I'm not as familiar with her catalog. Obviously if Rock Pile's involved, I'm going to check it out. And I thought that was a neat record. And she worked with NRBQ a little bit, and Al Anderson. She co-wrote a couple of really great songs with Al, or maybe she just sang some of Al's.
Yeah.
As well. And her readings of his material are always super fun. Yes, I obviously think she's great.
I had to ask though, because I know the Nick Lowe connection, and I love the song. I love the sound of Structured Class. Obviously, an incredible nod to that Jesus of Cool classic. I love the sound of Breaking Glass, which was such an incredible. Your song is fantastic, and I'm also a huge fan of the record Jesus of Cool. Have you had any run-ins with Nick Lowe in all of your travels?
I have not. The closest that I've come is Reckless Eric, who I worked with on a few demos. We worked with prior to A Goddamn Impossible Way of Life. I went up to his studio in upstate New York, where I think he and Amy just moved, but he was living with Amy Rigby in this little house in Hudson. And we made some demos, and he will tell stories for days about the Stiff Guys. They're probably not mine to tell, but I have not met Nick Lowe. But if I ever did, I don't know that I would know what to say anyway, because I'm just such a huge fan.
He is one of my favorite songwriters. And so anytime there's a nod to him, I have to seize on it. He's been on the show, and last year I saw him open for Elvis Costello here in Phoenix, and it was the Nick's set was fantastic. Low Straight Jackets was with him. I had only ever seen him solo before that, which is also tremendous. He's a great songwriter and a great crooner, you know, with the, just one guitar. But seeing him with the full rock band was great. And then Elvis Costello and his crew, they were, I have never seen a band play with time the way they did. It was Dylan-esque, you know, it was like such a strange, it was also very hot in the theater. The air conditioner wasn't working, and we're talking Phoenix in the summer. So I might have been slipping into like a delirious state, but but yeah, that was easily the strangest I've ever seen Elvis play. So that was a great thing. And it's funny to think about those guys. The Stiff Records thing must have seemed like a flash in the pan to even them a little bit, you know, like a splash. But here they are all these decades later, still creating pretty incredible art. What do you have a favorite Nick Lowe record?
I think I'm going to have to just jump on your train and say Jesus of Cool.
It's hard to argue with it unless you ask Nick Lowe. He doesn't think it's that good.
Oh, I'm sure that so when you interviewed him, did you have to ask him which of his catalog is his favorite, or was he just dismissive of it because he didn't want to talk about it?
No, it's just in the times that I've been fortunate enough to interview him a number of times, and the first time I was I was raving about it, and he was like, you know, it's so cool that you like that record so much. Like, I'm really moved, and I hear from people all the time who extol its virtues to me, and he's like, but I just hear this kid that's like, doesn't have any idea what he's doing, and I don't like what he ended up coming up with or whatever.
For sure.
Or he said something like, maybe I wrote a proper verse or something, is what he said. You know, he was just, I think, thinking about maybe the dashed off quality of that record. But I think it's just about as brilliant as it gets. I don't know what So It Goes is actually about. I can't quite figure out the story, but it feels like a movie in my head. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's one of those great impenetrable story songs that just endures. I wanted to ask you, if it's okay, like, when you saw Costello, was he playing with Charlie Sexton in his band?
He was, yeah.
Okay, that's cool. I'm wondering, like, if the Dylan-esque piece of it had something to do with
it could
Sexton's guitar playing. We've been jamming Love and Theft around the house recently, and I think I've got this right, but I think Charlie Sexton is playing guitar on that, and his guitar is so good on it, and makes that record really stand out. It's a great record on its own, but
for sure. Yeah, no, it was weird that when I say playing with time, I mean, it really felt psychedelic, but not in the way that people usually use that word. You know what I mean? But almost surrealistic in a strange way. It was like it's kind of elongating verses and phrases that don't normally stretch out as much as they do. And then other times it would be like he was like clattering through the lyrics in this sort of ramshackle way. It was just very free. It felt like the way the MC5 would always talk about how they were influenced by Sun Ra, you know?
Yeah.
And, when I was younger and more literally minded, I would be like, they don't sound like Sun Ra. Like, what are they talking? They just sound like Chuck Berry or whatever, you know? But then, you know, sort of like as you settle into things, you realize that the influence is not literal. It's sort of there more spiritually, and that they were trying to get in a more free context in terms of rock music. And that's really what I felt like Costello and his crew were doing. But Nick Lowe, I mean, he was just like pure showman, like absolutely classic. Sounds incredible on those songs. Doesn't sound, you know, at all aged. It's really pretty remarkable stuff.
Yeah, he's one to watch. I mean, yeah, I know. It's like, and his hair is still perfect too. I mean,
can you imagine? yeah, who you should be so lucky. Well, another guy who's sort of, you know, in that whole milieu is Joe Eli, and I know that Print the Legend has like a real Joe Eli feel, and you know, he's somebody who I don't know if people dig into him as much as they should these days either. But I do remember being in my most fervent record collecting days, and somebody told me, you got to check out Joe Eli. He's this like country guy, but he toured with the Clash. And I was like, well, that is a record I have to own. How did you get kind of into Joe's stuff?
Well, kind of the same way that you did. I knew of his affiliation and association with the Clash, and obviously, you know, he's famously in the room, you know, singing the Spanish parts of Should I Stay or Should I Go with Joe Strummer. And obviously anybody who Joe Strummer likes, I am honor bound to like, because I just love Joe Strummer so much. So I was aware of Joe Eli, and then, but like, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, never really thought to talk about a catalog that you could really dive into. I mean, like, I also had, you know, like heard Flatlander songs and, you know, really thought that that was cool. And, but it was really like, I want to say that it was like a Pitchfork Sunday review of one of his records, or maybe it was a box set that came out. I can't remember. I'll have to send you it, but it was so compelling. And it was such a well-written review that I was
that
like,
was,
you know,
yeah. Nadine Smith, I think, did that. Yeah. Incredible review. Incredible writer. Really, really good stuff. Yeah.
Yes. And I remember just blown away. And I was like, I've got to, you know, start listening more seriously. And not because I did not take Joe Eli seriously. It was just more like, this is a, you know, something that I it's just a blind spot culturally for me. And I don't know, probably just put on like the best of on Apple Music or something and heard his cover of, I think it's Robert Earl Keane's song originally called The Road Goes On Forever. And that was where I got the inspiration to write Print the Legend in the style of Joe Eli and also Joe Eli. But also tried to like throw in a little Spanish Bombs influence on it for Joe Strummer. So that one's for the Joes.
I love that. I love that very much. Yeah, he's another songwriter who, in the spirit of what we have said now about ZZ Top and Roseanne Cash and all these others, you know, wasn't afraid to like try things, wasn't afraid to play around with synths and digital stuff, like especially on high res or whatever. So, I mean, to me, I love that, you know, and that sort of the guitar that, you know, you're talking this, that's, I mean, that's just such a great little touch, and that's a really great song. And I'm a fan of the sentiment too of Printing the Legend. You know what I mean? That's a really fun song.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. That was one that just kind of, you know, came out right the second we played it, which it was not an easy recording session, I will tell you that, but Print the Legend, I think we did maybe two takes and it was perfect. It really locked in quickly. So that was one of those magic songs. And yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Peter Holzapfel of the DBs is playing guitar on this entire record and on that song, and what he did on the guitar with that. I mean, basically, you know, I just said, like, can you do like a Joe Eli thing? And he was like, yeah, sure, totally. And he just did that.
That's fantastic.
Like, as naturally as breathing. It was one of the most amazing things. I love the way that song sounds. And so I'm glad that it resonated because it's one of my faves.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go get on with the rest of your evening, there was one more figure that I wanted to touch on because I found your song very moving, your song Doug Yule from a few records back. Now, I think I think Doug Yule, you know, they say that it's good to have like somebody who you sort of like fight for and stick up for. I feel like Doug Yule gets so, he gets such a short shrift in terms of people recognizing what he brought to the Velvets. But nonetheless, Squeeze is a mark that he has never been able to live down, you know? Can you tell me about what inspired that song? Were you just thinking about what was going through your head with that one?
Well, credit where due, that was actually a song that my husband Timothy initially had the original idea for. And I think, you know, and he plays in the Paranoid style. And so, you know, we are a band that loves an underdog. And I think that, you know, for him, he just found Doug Yule to be a very moving figure. And he was a big fan of his reading of Candy Says and just thinks that he made such wonderful contributions and then became kind of this punchline. And it just sucks, you know? And so, you know, we kind of wrote that song, gosh, really early on. One of the first songs that like we worked on together, I want to say. And you know, it was really just trying to put yourself into the shoes of this, you know, this person who feels really misunderstood and, you know, kind of retreated from the public view. And you know, I feel we all kind of just felt sort of bad for him. And I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. It's hard not to kind of root for him. And so that was another song that did kind of, it took a long time to actually get a recording of it that we liked. We tried it a bunch of different ways, rewrote lyrics. So a bit of a breech birth on that one, but I always liked that song and I always liked the sentiment that like, you've just got to kind of keep fighting and, you know, believe in what you believe in. And so I swear I've got another record in me, you know, it was just like a sentiment that we felt very strongly at the time that we were doing for executive meeting was one that we were, which we're feeling at just at that moment. So just felt like a good song to try out. And it worked finally. I think that recording is good. Yeah. I think it came out well.
I liked it. And like I said, I'm a pro Yule, advocate. I believe that, I believe that to appreciate what Doug Yule brought to the Velvets takes nothing away from what John Cale brought to the Velvets. Two very different things, you know?
For sure.
But yeah. I mean, who does? I love Loaded. I think Loaded is such a great record and Loaded doesn't exist without Doug. You know, Doug is such a force on that record. And I don't know, you know, what ended up resulting in him not making the final record, but he played he does at least some demo type stuff for Coney Island Baby, which is a Lou record, a few records into the career, obviously. And I love that record. And I really like, I feel like there's some of those recordings with Yule have got out and they're really good. So there's that, you know, even Lou decided to return to Doug in some sense. So I like to imagine that was a healing thing. Who knows? Maybe not.
God, I hope so. Yeah, I have no idea. With Lou Reed, it's just impossible to tell.
It is impossible. It's impossible to know. But this has been so much fun having you on and getting a chance to nerd out about records and writing. And the new record is really great. And I've really enjoyed spending time with it and looking over the lyric sheet. And I think that the writer part of songwriter, you do a great job reminding folks that these are not contradictory things. So thank you for taking the time to chat with me about it. And thanks for doing it.
Oh, well, thank you so, so much for this conversation. And I only wish that we could go on because I feel like there are so many things that we could discuss. So I just appreciate you giving me a little bit of your time to talk about stuff, and especially to talk about the new record, which I'm so glad to hear that you're enjoying, because it's one that I'm super proud of. So what an honor. So we'll have to do it again sometime.
Or yeah,
we can play a show together.
I'd be happy to do both. Let's make it all happen. We'd love to have you back, and really appreciate you taking the time. So thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, talk to you soon.
All right, be well.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I produce, write, and host the show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton. Our music comes from Frank Mastin. You can find more of it over at mastin.bandcamp.com. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett. Our executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35, at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. If you want to get in touch, you can find my contact info at Aquarium Drunkard, or just email me at jasonpwoodbury@gmail.com. Would love to know what you think of the show, what you think of the season so far. We're really proud of the talks that we've been putting out, and we hope that you've been enjoying them. And I like to hear from listeners, so if you want to share some of your thoughts, please feel free to shoot them over. Next week on Transmissions, I am excited to announce that we'll be talking with Roger Eno. I had a really incredible talk with him, and I'm excited to share it with you all. So come back then. Be well in the meantime. Thanks for listening. This transmission is concluded.